So you picture this situation. You stand gripping the rail in court number one at the Old Bailey, the oldest court in the land. You did ask a police officer to preach on the trial. You have been accused of all the worst crimes you could possibly imagine could be committed. Murder, terrorism, kidnap, armed robbery, fraud, and GBH. You were arrested by the authorities, who deemed there was enough evidence to charge you for the offences and send you to said court. You know you're innocent. You are innocent. Yet you know the evidence will be construed to show otherwise. The judge turns to you and says, how do you plead? Would you not surely cry out at this point, I'm not guilty, Your Honour, my Lord? Why should you be silent when you're innocent? Why would you silently allow a sham trial to take place, finding you guilty, exacting the punishment due for the crimes you've been accused of? You wouldn't stand there silently, and you couldn't stand there silently. Thankfully, the UK justice system is not like this, but we join the series in Mark when Jesus is at this very moment. He's been betrayed by one of his disciples, arrested by the chief priests, and has been sent to a Roman court held before Pilate. So we start off looking at the first five verses and the first audience with Pilate. We read that very early in the morning, the chief priests with the elders, the teachers of the law, and the whole Sanhedrin made their plans. So they bound Jesus, led him away, and handed him over to Pilate. Which invites a few questions. Why so early? Trials in Roman courts would often start before daylight came, much unlike now where you're lucky to be seen before about 10:30. Roman officials always wanted to get the trials out of the way as soon as they could in the day to continue with their other duties. And if the Jewish leaders didn't get Jesus to the court in time, it's unlikely that he would have been heard that day. And then we ask, why did they need to deliver him? Why didn't they just deal with him themselves, given that they believe him to be guilty of the crimes they accuse him? We see that Jews no longer had the power to exact the law as they saw fit. They were under the law of the Romans, and of 7 AD, their right to exact the death sentence was revoked, deferring that power centrally to Rome. This was seen as an insult by the Jewish people and a cultural and national disaster that they could no longer punish their own criminals. It showed that they were completely under the thumb, under the ruling hand of Rome. We read later on in Acts how they disregard this when they stone Stephen. So why did the Jewish leaders not take the law into their own hands in the case of Jesus? Because the Jewish leaders were cunning. And they were a culturally conscious group. They identified that the political fallout of killing Jesus themselves would be too great. Jesus was too popular amongst the people. Handing Jesus to the Romans distanced them from the final decision. But in doing so, in handing Jesus over, they fulfilled the prophecy of Jacob. The scepter has departed from Judah and the lawgiver from between his feet. And Shiloh the messenger, whom God had promised to send, must have come. In their leaders' wickedness and in their folly, God uses them to fulfill his redemption plan. The very people who should have known these prophecies and seen what they were doing were very blind to that fact. So why deliver him to Pilate? Pilate was a man of strong reputation. A reputation for brutality and a record of distaste for the Jews. One contemporary Jewish historian called Philo describes him as being a violent thug, fond of executions without trial. Another, Josephus, records that at the start of his term, Pilate provoked the Jews by ordering the Roman imperial standards to be carried into Jerusalem, but he eventually backed off from an all-out confrontation with the Jews. He also helped himself to Jewish revenues to build himself an aqueduct. It seems that he found the Jews to be a stubborn and distrustful people, resulting in him questioning the motives behind the Jews, bringing him a prisoner to exact a sentence upon. But we read on that Pilate allows the trial to take place, and in doing so, he has to follow the strict rules of Roman court. So there are five steps. The plaintiff brought an indictment against the accused. The magistrate, or judge, examined both the accusation and the accused. Then the two main sources of evidence were the statements of the accused and the evidence brought by witnesses either for or against the accused. And all the evidence was in. The court official declared that all the evidence was in. And from there, the magistrate was free to consult with his advisers and then announce his verdict from the judgment seat. The sentence was executed immediately from there. So we join the trial at this second step. The judge, Pilate, is examining the accused as he asks, "Are you the king of the Jews?" You may notice at this point that the accusation put before him in the Roman courts is somewhat different to when he was before the Sanhedrin. He was there accused of claiming to be God himself. So why change tact when putting him before Pilate? To answer this, we can ask two questions. Were the Romans monotheistic? And what would their reaction be to another god or someone claiming to be God? Now, we know from the history that the Romans were not monotheistic. They held many gods, Jupiter, Juno, and Minerva being the big three. They held different gods in a national sense, and often households would have their own gods that they would worship in private. So why would Pilate care about someone claiming to be God? Well, the answer is he wouldn't. He just couldn't care less if another man claimed to be God. And in fact, given that Jesus was a man of repute, he was known for his miracles and his acts, it's not a stretch to imagine that the Romans would potentially welcome him as another God. So that approach would clearly not have worked for the Sanhedrin. It wouldn't have endeared the accusation to Pilate. So instead, they present Jesus as a political threat to Caesar, placing him as king of the Jews above Caesar, which could never be permitted, forcing Pilate's hands to hold the trial. Jesus replied to Pilate's questioning, "You have said so," stating that he is indeed being called the king of the Jews, but his answer is a yes with a reservation. Because of that, Pilate must investigate further before he can carry out any judgment. It's likely, had Jesus plainly said yes to that accusation, that the sentence would have been exacted then and Pilate would have had him killed. We read that the chief priests then accused him of many more things, not just for claiming to be the king of the Jews. As we read in Luke 23, verse 2, they began to accuse him, saying, "We have found this man subverting our nation. He opposes payment of taxes to Caesar and claims to be Messiah, a king." Pilate is clearly unconvinced by the Jewish leaders' claims, and they continue to pile further accusations upon Jesus. Further listed in further on in Luke 23, verse 5, he stirs up all the people over Judea by his teaching. He started in Galilee and has come all the way here. So Pilate addresses Jesus again, inviting him to give evidence against these claims. Pilate is then amazed by the reaction of Jesus. In all his years residing over the Roman Empire in the courts, it's doubtful that he ever witnessed a defendant who was charged facing the death sentence who would stand there silently before him. I'm sure, given what we know of Roman culture and their concept of sport, that they were, and what we know of Pilate's character as well, that he woke up no doubt relishing the thought of popping to court and sending a few guilty Jews to their death. We think of thousands of spectators in the Colosseums, baying for blood, and he had his own front row seat of his own personal theatre of bloodshed, where he was there, the king. He no doubt expected you to beg for your life, and no doubt he wanted you to beg for your life before him. He wanted that power. Jesus, who was guilty of no sin, stood to be condemned as a guilty man before Pilate. Betrayed by his friend, despised by his own people, rejected by the religious leaders who should have seen who he was rather than send him to death. Of all people to ever speak up and proclaim their innocence in court, Jesus would be vindicated and justified in doing just so. Isaiah 53 and verse 7, he was oppressed and he was afflicted, yet he opened not his mouth. Like a lamb that is led to the slaughter, and like a sheep that is before his shearers is silent, so he opened not his mouth. As the first Adam stood guilty before God and tried to excuse himself from committing the first sin, the second Adam stood before a court of man in humble silence. Jesus showed humility beyond imagination. So I say again, why should you be silent if you're innocent? Why would you silently allow a sham trial to take place to find you guilty, exacting the punishment due for the accused crimes? You wouldn't stand there, and you couldn't. But Jesus did. Jesus did that very thing. And what a lesson we can learn from our Saviour in bearing under oppression and struggling through the hardest of times. How often in this country do we complain about the tiniest of things? There's not enough salt in my meal. This tea's too weak. I'm hungry. I'm too full, more often than not. It's too hot. And then when it's winter, it rains too much. We live in a nation of perennial complainers, and no doubt we get sucked into that as well. Even though most of the time we don't have anything to complain about. But it seems like good sport at the time. Now, I don't want to trivialize people's genuine sufferings that may be in your life through, be it physical, mental, psychological means, or struggles with specific sins. Perhaps it's balancing finance, finding work, being at work, or raising children, or anything that is in your life that you are genuinely struggling with. But rather to address how we react to those sufferings. If we are to truly suffer in our lives, how would you respond to it? Would we be provoked to complain? Or would we seek to be like Jesus, patient and humble in the face of true suffering? We're not promised a life of ease when we follow Christ. We're promised, in fact, the polar opposite. We should pray then for ourselves and for others, those here today, that we would be more like him who knew no sin. He who stood innocent, condemned by the men he came to save, who stood facing immense physical and spiritual torment, suffered that in silence. We should pray that in suffering that we would reflect Jesus, that his love and his grace would be evident through our lives. We read in 1 Peter chapter 2, verses 20 to 23, but how it is to your credit if you receive a beating for doing wrong and endure it. But if you suffer for doing good and you endure it, then it is commendable before God. To this you were called, because Christ suffered for you, leaving you an example that you should follow in his steps. He committed no sin, and no deceit was found in his mouth. When they hurled their insults at him, he did not retaliate. When he suffered, he made no threats. Instead, he entrusted himself to him who judges justly. If you are suffering here today, take heart. When suffering comes your way, take heart also. If you're having a hard time at work this week or a hard time at home, remember Jesus at the trial. Jesus knows what you're going through. Jesus has been there himself. Jesus cares for you, and Jesus is with you. Now we move on to verses 6 to 15, and the second audience with Pilate, and it's very clear that Pilate did not believe that Jesus was guilty. Luke 23:14 sheds further light. He says, "You brought a man to me as one who incites the people to rebellion. And behold, having examined him before you, I have found no guilt in this man regarding the charges which you make against him." But Pilate had a huge political problem on his hands. Does he release Jesus or condemn an innocent man to die, to prevent any unrest between him and the Jewish leaders? He's stuck in a quandary. Added to this, you have Pilate's inbuilt dislike for the Jewish leaders. He can see through their motives, and this is likely fueling his will to oppose them and oppose their wishes to have Jesus killed. So Pilate is approached by the crowd and asked if he can release a prisoner, as was his tradition on the Passover day. Pilate sees this as an opportunity to do what is right. Why wouldn't the Jewish people want their king released back to them, he thinks. Pilate has a win-win situation here. He can be preserved from any political backlash, where the crowds, who he believes, when he asks them who they want to release, they will cry out for Jesus. Here, perversely, is a Roman leader sympathizing with a Jewish criminal and seeking to find a way to have him released back to his people. So he asked the crowds, "What shall I do with Jesus?" And they were very clear in their wish. Release another man, an insurrectionist called Barabbas, a man who was involved in a failed Jewish revolt against the Roman people. These local Jews had an intense distrust of Pilate, much as he had an intense distrust of them. And it's possible that they would, regardless of the situation, oppose what Pilate offered them. The Jews would always side with their leaders in the Sanhedrin rather than a Roman official. There's a suggestion amongst some scholars that the crowd was made of local Jews, and the travelling Jews were outside the city at the time, given how early it was in the morning. And there's also maybe a suggestion that the crowd was present originally for the release of Barabbas, but it's quite clear from the passage that the Jewish leaders are fueling this. So, regardless of the crowd's initial motive, their actions continue to further God's redemption plan for man. "What then do you want me to do with him whom you call the King of the Jews?" Pilate says, probably hoping the crowd would be satisfied with a lesser punishment, maybe just a beating, and then letting Jesus go. But no, the crowd cry out to him, "Crucify him." The most horrific methods of torture and death that man has ever created is what they choose for Jesus. Pilate was no doubt surprised and horrified by their response to him. No doubt the herd mentality of the crowds started to pick up, and those on the fringes were starting swept up into a frenzy as they start to chant, "Crucify him." And you hear Pilate sort of shouting over them, "Why? What crime has he committed?" And the crowd is in full swing, screaming, "Crucify him. Crucify him," baying for his blood. So Pilate now has an even bigger problem on his hands, that he's bordering on having a riot in his courthouse. Nothing would annoy his superiors more than having a riot in court, and then he would have the awkward situation of explaining how it arose. So Pilate now has both the Jewish leaders and the crowds baying for Jesus' blood, and sees no other option but to pass sentence on him. Pilate's free will and Pilate's apparent conscience has been eroded. It's been crippled by his need for public and peer approval. In pronouncing the sentence, the mode of death had to be specified in Roman law, and it can be assumed that Pilate said to Jesus at that point, "You shall mount the cross." In the closing words of Jesus' trial, we see a man, Pilate, who has no true faith. He has no fear of Yahweh, holding office in a district of the Roman Empire. A man in a high place with no religious principles is one of the most pitiable sights in the world. To quote J.C. Ryle, he says that he is like a large ship tossed to and fro on the sea without a compass or a rudder. His very greatness surrounds him with temptations and snares. It gives him power for good or for evil, which, if he knows not how to use it aright, it is sure to bring him into difficulties and make him unhappy. This here is why we are called to pray for our leaders, to pray for our MPs, to pray for those in the House of Commons, the House of Lords. Pray for those who rule that they will make good decisions, that they will make godly decisions, that they wouldn't be swayed or carried by the hot topic for the moment. To put aside the spin doctor approach that we've become all too accustomed to and make decisions with honesty and integrity. We need to pray in a country that is not ruled by people of faith, that God would have his way in this land and that they would be used for his purposes. We also see here the guilt of the Jewish people in the death of Jesus. The entire events of the past 12 hours were orchestrated to perfection by the Jewish leaders, from Jesus' betrayal to his capture to him being presented to Pilate. From there, they stirred up the people to have Barabbas freed over Christ. Every opportunity was afforded to them by Pilate during the trial to have Jesus released and then given a lesser sentence, but they would only be satisfied with one outcome, the death of Jesus. They embraced Barabbas, a man whose name means son of the father, a man who was a terrorist and a murderer convicted by Roman law. They accepted a false son of the father, but in doing so condemned the Lord of life to death. Their acts showed their true wickedness, their coerciveness, their blindness and their folly. We no doubt feel a wealth of emotion when we read how they had our Jesus condemned to death. We should heed the warning of their actions and make sure that we have not chosen Barabbas and instead have chosen Christ. That we would not be blind to see who Jesus really is as they were. That Jesus is the Saviour of the world. That he endured this sham trial in silence, knowing that he would soon be hung on a tree, forsaken by his Father, bearing our sin. In releasing Barabbas, the Jewish leaders have unwittingly provided a perfect gospel illustration. Barabbas, a guilty man, deserving of his punishment, is set free. And in his place, Jesus is put to death. The murderer lives. The Prince of Peace is led to a gruesome death. If anyone should be able to say, "Jesus died for me," is it not Barabbas? He knew what it was to have Jesus die on his behalf, the innocent in the place of the guilty. Even in Jesus' trial, we see an illustration of God's salvation plan. We see how God pardons and justifies the ungodly. He pardons us because Christ has suffered in our place, the just for the unjust. We deserve punishment, but the perfect substitute has suffered for us. We deserve eternal death, but Jesus suffered it for us. We're all by nature in the position of Barabbas. We are guilty, we are wicked, and worthy of condemnation. Jesus was handed over to be beaten, whipped, and scourged within an inch of his life, marred beyond all recognition. Nailed to the cross, to hang in shock and agony, awaiting a slow and painful death of asphyxiation, so that we today can be free. Jesus bore it all so that we could be offered that free gift, the free gift of salvation that is offered here tonight if you put your trust in him. So we move to the third and final sort of point, as it were, as Jesus carries his cross in verses 16 to 20. So as the soldiers led Jesus away, they began a series of humiliating and brutal events. They mocked Jesus' place as king and placed a crown of thorns on his head, placing royal robes on his body, giving him a scepter to rule before mocking him with their false worship. They took turns to spit on him and to beat him with no mercy. Why would a Roman soldier hold back on a Jew who's being condemned? They beat him with all their might before stripping him of the mocking symbols they adorned him with and leaving him with nothing. Bruised, bleeding, broken skin, and broken bones. As they would cry out to Caesar as he passed, all hail Caesar, they mock Jesus with their chants of, "Hail, King of the Jews. Look at him now, broken and naked. What kind of king is he?" they say. When they were finally done and the beatings ended, Jesus was given his own clothes to wear and was sent to bear his cross, bearing its massive weight on his scarred shoulders. Why did Jesus take the punishment? Because he was acting in obedience to the Father. He knew that he was walking to the place where he would die, but he kept going out of obedience to him and for his great love for us. 1 Peter 2, verse 24 says, "He himself bore our sins in his body on the cross so that we might die to sins and live for righteousness. By his wounds you have been healed." Without Christ's obedience to God's salvation plan, we today would be helpless. Without him, we would be dead in our sin, with no escape. It's because of Christ's love, great love for the world, and his obedience to the Father to the end, that we can stand on judgment day, knowing that our sin has been dealt with by him. As Jesus takes the punishment that we here today deserve, we are set free. Jesus is showing us what he meant when he said back in Mark chapter 8, verse 34, "If anyone wishes to come after me, he must deny himself and take up his cross and follow me." We today are not called to militant action. We're called to be how Christ was on that day, humble in the face of oppression, suffering with grace that only God can give, and to be obedient to our Father in heaven. The Redeemer has come. He lived a perfect life so that through his death, he bore our sin so that in the courtroom of the Almighty, where we will all stand, he can intercede on our behalf. So when you are asked, and I am asked, by God, how do you plea to the charges put before you when all your sin is shown to you? Jesus can step in and say for you, not guilty. Amen.